Sam.
Richard. I'm still going to ask the first questions. So when I got here yesterday at Paddington, strange enough, the first thing I encountered was a young woman being wheeled into an ambulance, and clearly something pretty catastrophic had happened to her. And it, not for the first time, but every time for some reason, it's striking that life is fragile, that there's a moment here and there's a moment here, and something, either an event or news, separates a period of being okay from not. And medicine, alongside maybe religion and other disciplines, but medicine certainly meets the fragility of humanity all the time. And I don't know, I wonder sometimes about the shape of that encounter, to what extent it's adequate. And I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Well, we've just had 3 years where we've experienced the fragility of individual lives, 20 million of them, but the positive sense of rebirth of humanity, which is wonderful to hear. And that's a reckoning that we haven't, disappointingly, we haven't come to terms with. We had an opportunity with this pandemic to really reflect on who we are, who we want to be, what we owe each other. The pandemic held a mirror up to our society and found us wanting in many ways, the injustices, the inequities, partly because it wasn't just a virus, it was a virus that interacted with a set of chronic illnesses patterned over many social gradients, gender gradients, ethnicity gradients, economic gradients. And we had a moment where we could step back and look at the fragility of our, as you put it, our humanity, our society, and relate that to the fragility of the human body. And this has been an opportunity for us to not just reflect on it, but to do something about it. And we seem to have thrown that opportunity away. There's still a chance that we can come back and reflect on it, but right now we're struggling with how to remember the last 3 years. Mostly we don't want to. We seem to want to just move on and turn our backs on it, which is extraordinary. There's a sense of emptiness, I think. We live in a society now where there are deceptions everywhere. It feels more than disappointing where we are right now.
See, I remember in those first months of the pandemic, even the first weeks, thinking something, the whole business of medicine's encounter with finitude and mortality does feel certainly sharpened in the whole business of oncology for me, and something I tussle with a lot. I remember when the pandemic came in thinking, surely this will go some way towards some kind of wider conversation around what medicine's relationship with that, at that point, very vast fragility will be. But it interestingly, that both at the time, in terms of the attention primarily on ventilators and as opposed to palliative care for those in nursing homes, and even since, in my specialty, the proliferation of endless new technology that is primarily geared towards prolonging life rather than easing suffering. Medicine, the duties of medicine, to what extent are they life prolongation, or ought to be life prolongation, for instance, as opposed to the alleviation of suffering? And have we got that balance right?
Well, we shouldn't knock it, my friend, because I'm very grateful to your community for inventing drugs that have certainly kept me alive. I should not be here now if it was not for the invention of a set of drugs which didn't exist a decade ago, let alone when I qualified in the 1980s. So I think it's very easy to be critical of the pharmaceutical industry, critical of the transactional nature of medicine, to be critical of the of the medical industrial complex, and we've all done that, and that's fine. But it's actually quite nice to be alive too. and I don't want to exchange the medical industrial complex for the last 3 years that I've still been kicking around here. And there's now, you know, we've gone through a revolution in your specialty in the last decade. Something like 40% of people who are diagnosed with cancer, and you know, about one in three people in society will have a diagnosis of cancer. About 40% of those patients are eligible to receive immunotherapy. And as I say, we didn't have the first immunotherapeutic drug was licensed in 2011. The Nobel Prize was awarded to two individuals, James Allison and Tasaku Honju, in 2018 for the discovery of immunotherapy. I mean, this is amazing. It's not a cure. It's not perfect. There are some nasty side effects. But overall, it has changed the face of one branch of medicine. Yes. And that's important. I think the challenge is that we now have a group of people, and it's actually not just in oncology, it's for any condition where people are being managed, living with, and in this audience, there'll be people with a diagnosis, you're living with it. You're not healthy in the sense of free of disease, but you're here. And what we're not very good at is dealing with people in medicine who are alive, but not necessarily free of disease. And that's difficult. You know, when I go to see my oncologist, I love her to death, but, you know, it's, hello, Richard, yes, blood test, great. How are you? Fabulous. Scan, bit bad here, but good here. See you in a month. There's your prescription. And it's fine, but it's like 2 minutes, and that's it. She never touches me. Do you remember when we trained? It was all about clinical examination, wasn't it? We were feeling each other's livers and listening to lungs and heart sounds and stuff. I don't think for 3 or 4 years, and I've had God knows how many operations, nobody has laid a stethoscope on my chest at all. And that, I mean, perhaps that's medicine today, I don't know.
It's interesting because you refer to that period, and a lot of us are quite disorientated in oncology with these profoundly extended remissions and lives from immunotherapy that would have been unthinkable, genuinely unthinkable, a decade ago.
Absolutely.
But you have referred to it to me as an extended limbo.
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, I don't know if any of you, if you read Dante's Inferno, in Canto 4, the first circle of hell is limbo. And it's quite apt that to say that. The great thing about the first circle of hell is that it's for virtuous pagans. And so that's where we all are. Those of us who have a diagnosis of something, but we're still here, we are in the first circle of hell. It's very apt. And actually, all the great physicians were in the first circle of hell. Hippocrates was there, Galen was there, because it was for the original sin, for the unbaptized. So you know that's where we are. We're living in this strange void where you don't quite know when your time is going to run out. You know that you're not going to get to 80, but I'm 61, and so I might get to 62 or 63 or who knows. But you know, I feel pretty good now. But it's this strange place where you are. And how do you deal with that? You know, medicine's not set up to deal with this enlarging number of people who are, you know, living in this suspended state. And that's a bit tricky, actually. Oncology can't deal with that. You do great things, but you don't deal with that very well. But what are we going to have? We're not going to have an army of psychotherapists. I've had therapy. I love therapy. Everybody should have therapy. But, you know, 170 quid for 50 minutes, I can't afford that. That's what it costs in Marylebone. And so, you know, what do we do with these people?
And I know that it's important to say it's not a position of comfort for you, as it wouldn't be for me to talk about oneself here. But
no, you know what?
Let's do it.
You go through all that. You know, I stood in front of the bathroom mirror in the morning and thought, shit, what the fuck is going on here? You know, why me? But you go through that because you've just got to figure out, you know what? This is just the way it is.
But when you talk about an extended limbo, and without wanting to, I haven't had that experience, but in many ways it's a stretch out. That extended limbo is true of all of us,
exactly.
Isn't it? We're all living on a...
That's exactly right. Exactly.
And you know, I've, for lots of reasons, never expect to live particularly long, hopefully to the end of the today. how do you... such as it is, without... And it'll... You know, what is your response to that? You've talked about wanting to seize strongly onto joy and for that to be a live phenomenon day to day.
Yes, no, I mean, I wanted to write a column in The Lancet, but didn't quite have the courage, entitled The Joy of Cancer. And I do genuinely mean that, because it gives you the chance to... I mean, you're a different person when it's not just for cancer, for anything, any condition. You are a different person once you've been diagnosed with something. You're different after that diagnosis compared with before, even if it's just psychologically, but often physically. You know, people have bits taken out of them. You are different. And that gives you a chance to rediscover yourself. And we don't always get a chance in life to rediscover who we are. And then we also have the opportunity to say, because now it's the perfect excuse, you know what, I'm going to decide to be the person I want to be, and I don't have to fit in with the norms of what everybody else wants. I now have the perfect excuse to tell somebody to, you know... And it's a very, very... I can tell you, it's very liberating to be the person you want to be, because you have the best excuse in the world. You know, it was actually... I know this sounds a bit glib, but in one way, but I think Montaigne got it right, because he wrote several essays about... he was totally hypochondriac and melancholic. But what he said was that you only achieve true freedom and happiness by dying, because that's the only way you get away from the uncertainties, the constraints, the subjections of society, everything that stops you from doing anything. The only liberation is death. And I find that actually immensely comforting, because, you know, it is true that actually, you know, it is very frustrating, the things that you can't do. And, well, there's the moment ahead.
Something really important, though, and for me personally, that you said to me about a year ago, which was...
I said to you?
Yeah.
We may have been drinking.
No, we were drinking. We were in Soho, and it was a good place. But you said about how when something like a remission is achieved in a chronic illness and a position of recovery, to use Francis' phrase, or health is stabilised, we're really bad. I'm conscious of this in articulating, and it may be that we haven't got the language, adequate language for it, to articulating for someone under our care, this is now important time, this time that we have somehow seized. Medicinally, is precious time. It's finite.
Yeah.
What, you know, and Atul Gawande talks about this, doesn't he? Actually asking the question, what's the most important thing to you here in this context? And I just wonder if, as you say, the NHS isn't equipped to deal with this. I've always felt that some of the challenge is resource, but also some of its sensibility and orientation in our care for others, and being able to be truthful about limited remissions and what's important for the person. Finding the language for this stuff feels really important.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to be... it's a cliche to talk about being defined by your whatever your diagnosis is. I mean, I try and put this little thing inside me, in various places inside me, in a little box, and tie it up with a bright ribbon and hide it away somewhere in my brain. That does for me. It means that I don't think about it every day, and I can compartmentalize it. And when I need to think about it, I can take it out of its little enribboned box, but the rest of the time I don't. So I don't, you know, this is where the beauty of modern medicine has come in. I mean, if we step outside of the cancer area for a moment, I can remember I qualified in medicine in 1986, a long time ago. When I was practicing medicine, if you were over 70 and you had chest pain, you definitely did not go to the coronary care unit. You were chucked onto a ward, and if you died, well, you were over 70, so you'd had your time. Now, that sounds horrendous today, but that was only 40 years ago, 35 years ago. If you had a stroke, you put a drip in the person and stick them on the right-hand side farther all the way down on the Nightingale ward. And again, forget about them, expecting that they wouldn't be there the following morning. That's not what you do with patients who've had a stroke today. So we have, you know, again, the tendency is to be relentlessly negative about modern medicine.
Not at all.
But we shouldn't be.
No, I agree with you, we shouldn't be, but I think it's still, the onus is on us to at least applaud that.
Yeah.
At the same time, challenge some of the paradigms that favour that in isolation over and above. For instance, yeah. And you're a politically minded man heading up a politically minded journal who will wonder about the means by which, for instance, hospices in this country will be largely charitably funded, yeah, as opposed to acute wards and the like. So one might hope for more balance whereby we can achieve extraordinary gains of life extension, yet you are still left, I think, thinking, what about this other stuff that's really important in terms of support care language? What about palliative care? How do we get a balance right?
Social care.
And social care,
I mean,
absolutely.
I think that's one of the lessons of the pandemic that we have politically chosen not to address. There is this UK COVID inquiry going on at the moment. It has endless modules, and they're only doing modules 1, 2, and 3, and they've got public hearings this summer. It's going to take forever, but we can't wait for that to finish before we take action. And that's we are missing this opportunity to take action about social care, about palliative care.
And I just wonder to what extent medicine has a responsibility in politically articulating the importance of these other facets, indeed, of health and alleviation of suffering over and above our often narrow, if extraordinary, vista,
yeah,
around biologicals and life extension.
I mean, we always get into trouble at The Lancet because people say, when they don't like something we've written, that we're mixing politics with medicine.
Yes.
But I mean, it is by definition, medicine is political. The whole sanitary movement of the 19th century was a political movement. So we have a duty is quite a strong word, but I think it's right. We have a duty to engage politically on the issues that we are responsible for. And that's not just medicine in the sense of patient care, what we've been talking about. I think it is literally about human survival, about the survival of the biosphere on which we depend. So issues around climate and health, issues around biodiversity, I think the health professions have a responsibility to be on the front lines of fighting around that. You know, life is a struggle. We are in a struggle around the way we word the world, the way we describe the world, and words matter. And I think that doctors, nurses, midwives, all the health professions together must be engaged in that struggle. You know, I'm not a communist, but it is interesting to read Antonio Gramsci. You know, if you look at his prison notebooks, he talked about, he was writing them at the time where military metaphors were very common, and he talked about the idea of a war of position. And he was trying to understand why in Europe all the revolutions after the Bolshevik Revolution failed. And he argued that we've misunderstood why political discontent occurs. It's not just about the economy, it is about culture. And the way the prevailing power structures of capitalism stop social change is because they win a war of position about culture. And that's what we're seeing today. I mean, every day I read the Daily Mail, and I read the Daily Mail partly to get me angry, but I read it because that is what Middle England reads, and it is the only way for me to understand part of my country which I don't understand. And when you read the Daily Mail, you realise that they are engaged in a culture war, a war of position, Gramsci would call it. It is up to us, those who don't agree with the editorial line of the Daily Mail, to respond also with a war of position.
Yes.
We have to engage.
And a natural consequence of that is to ask questions around, in a world that prides itself on progress, how it is still possible for costly immunotherapies, for all their wins in some corners of the world, are possible at the same time as a lack of simple analgesia in other parts of the world. And
I don't buy this idea that the money isn't there. I mean, the money was there for the pandemic, and we're still here, and society's still here. I think it's political choice.
And by political choice, us as citizens and how we contribute to that political discourse.
That's absolutely right. And I do feel that there's an opportunity, your children, my daughter, everybody else, the baby at the back of the hall, there is an opportunity for a generational social change over the next 20 or 30 years. I've never seen a cohort of young people more angry and more unwilling to accept the status quo than the cohort of people between the ages of 18 and 25 who I see today. I've never seen a group more mobilised ever in my lifetime. So I feel very optimistic about what we can achieve.
And final words then, vision of medicine over the next 20, 50 years? If you were in a place to articulate it, what would that look like?
Well, the vision for me is the Lancet, the concept the Lancet has really developed in the last decade, and Gavin mentioned it, is this idea of planetary health. That the health of, you can think of in medicine of the health of the human body, you can think in public health terms of the health of society, but we need to think much bigger than that. The health of our planetary systems. And our planetary systems are very, very sick. And we, as concerned individuals with health, should be diagnosing and mobilizing ourselves to address those planetary systems. And I do feel optimistic that we are beginning to do so and building momentum to literally protect that intergenerational equity, which is foundational to our species.
Richard Horton.
Thank you.